Ronananian.
That's the kind of stuff that makes auto repair exciting. That's the kind of stuff that makes you sit there and say, this is why you do it, right? To do the impossible, but the teamwork and the camaraderie.
I'm your vehicle, baby.
The Car Doctor. So let me ask you this. Is the pump completely dead?
It's dead as long as you beat on the tank with a rubber mallet, it'll pump. But as soon as you stop, it quits.
Welcome to the radio home of Ron and Anian, The Car Doctor. Since 1991, this is where car owners the world over turn to for their definitive opinion on automotive repair. If your mechanic's giving you a busy signal, pick up the phone and call in. The garage doors are open.
But I am here to take your calls at 855-560-9900.
And now, here's Ronnie.
Oh, is it my turn to talk now? Gee, that's just, I'm glad. Let's wander over. Let's go talk to Alex in New Jersey, 17 Pacifica. And we're going to talk about transmission fluid again. Alex, welcome to the Car Doctor, sir. How can I help?
Hey, Ron. Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hey, I called 2 weeks ago, and I talked about how I had problems getting a dealer to go and change my transmission fluid. And I called three dealers. One of them transferred to, when I called the service department, they transferred me over to the parts department, and they figured out that I need 24 quarts to do a flush on the transmission. And then when they transferred me over to service, I got the phone hung up on me. And then I called back, and they just kept on hanging up the phone, which is very, very strange. And then I called another dealer, and they went and told me it's they really do not recommend changing the transmission fluid, and it's a drop pan deal. So the third dealer just completely just refused to do it. Ultimately, here I got a price for one change. It was like $590. And he told me that with the stipulation that we do not want to do this oil change. This is really on you. We don't want to do it. This is a fill for life transmission. There is nothing on this transmission as far as changing the fluid. There's nothing to be done here.
And it is a filled for life. And that's, you know, it's such an odd term, right? Filled for life. Whose life? Is it going to last your lifetime? Is it going to last the life that you own the vehicle? Is, you know, what does filled for life mean? Now, the ZF fluid that they're using in that, to my knowledge, is no different than the fluid that they're using in a lot of the Highline BMW and Mercedes vehicles. And, you know, 200,000 miles, you're putting transmissions in some of those vehicles. So it's not that it's going to last forever. You know... Is it that these guys don't want to change the fluid? I get why they don't want to do the filter, because the filter requires transmission removal to get to it, all right? But do they want to not do the fluid because it's a 17 and they haven't done any yet? Are they waiting for these to fail and, you know, look at the track record and then then decide? You know, I don't get that. I think I would, you know, listen, it's got 100,000 miles on it, if I remember right, Alec.
A little bit more than that now, but yeah.
You know, I don't see a problem in doing a fluid change. And are they saying that they're afraid to change the fluid, that it's going to cause an issue?
They're saying that it's just something that's just totally not recommended. It's not prescribed by Chrysler, and therefore it's just not to do it. I mean, I asked about severe service or anything like that. And they're just like, it's just a fill for life. And they don't seem to have their act in order in terms of, one dealer told me it was a drop pan. The other dealer tells me something else. And then there was, there were a couple of details I'm forgetting right now. But the two dealers were saying different things about the same transmission, about how to go service this guy. I don't know. They left me on hold for a long time. And
because
you're
probably the first guy to call up and make the request.
Yeah. I actually called up Chrysler Corporate, and they said, like, I'm going to research this for you. And I was on hold for 40 minutes, and I had to hang up at some point because, like, I have other things to do. That's where I'm at. So, I mean, you would change the transmission fluid?
I would. You know, if I'm interested in longevity, you've got over 100,000 miles on it. You know, I would look at the color, the condition. I would also ask them, if you're telling me it's filled for life, what happens if the trans gets a leak? You know, and we have to do fluid. What, we're not going to change the fluid? We're not going to you know, drain out what's in there? I don't know that I would do a flush, but I would definitely feel good about exchanging the fluid or draining the fluid out and putting in fresh and maybe draining it out again. And it's to me, it's a simple drain and fill, and the refill procedure is a little difficult because of the lack of a dipstick in their hindsight. You know, it's not the end of the world, brother. It's find a dealership that wants to do it. See if you can maybe walk in there with a, you know, a box of donuts and a cup of coffee and talk to the trans guy and say, you know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing any failures? And you know, at what mileage? You know, you're trying to avoid. I'll leave it here. Let's leave it here, Alex. You're trying to avoid cancer before you get it. You know, the worst part about dealing with cancer, I think, is, you know, don't wait till you get it to do something. Get better health habits, stop smoking, you know, the whole drill. Do fluid maintenance, not just trans, but fluid maintenance in general on a vehicle before the vehicle gets to the point where it needs a component. And I think that's what you're trying to do. And I know of no fluid, again, what's lifetime? Define lifetime. Let's say you want to drive this car to 500,000 miles. They're telling you that trans is going to last till 500,000 miles with no fluid changes. And if you want to put $500 or $600 in it every couple of years and do a fluid change, I don't see a problem with that. Just make sure the shop that does it is qualified and competent. Let us know where you end up. Let's go over and talk to Mackenzie, who's looking to leave a dealer. Look at this, a mechanic. I'm going to be Father Ron here. Yes, Mackenzie, welcome aboard, sir. How can I help?
Hey, Ron. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Tell me your story, my son.
So I'm a Honda mechanic, work at a Honda dealership in North Jersey. I love working on cars. You know, I've been there for 9 years. My only experience, you know, in the automotive field. And I don't like where everything's going nowadays. Seems like I'm spending more time on a computer doing, you know, stupid updates and stuff like that than I am actually working on cars. And it's taken away from
the joy,
the fun, and you know, the want to continue.
Right.
So I'm torn. I have a few options to go to smaller dealerships, smaller shops, you know, private shops. But the money is very good at the dealership. We're a very busy dealership, but it's just every year it seems like there's more and more just complications, compute, you know, everything's more computers and everything else. And it's just, you know, I don't want to be 30, 40, 50 years old just sitting there with a computer plugged into a car, not physically fixing something, you know?
Right. Well, I think the act of a computer plugged into a car is a huge part of the future of the business. And I don't think you're going to get away from that regardless of where you are. You know, I think that, and having seen what dealers have become over the past 15, 20 years, you tend to be a number, not a name. It's you've got to produce X number of hours, you know, and tell me where I'm wrong, because I want to know from my own knowledge, but you tend to become a number. You've got to produce X number of hours. You've got to get this many PDIs or this many reflashes or this many recall campaigns done, and it tends to burn you out. It's repetitive work.
Yep.
You know, and it's I get it. It's a different kind of work. Independent repair shops tend to see the problems when that car that's four or 5 years old, where the dealer tech sees that car when it's 2 to 3 years old. It's very different types of repair work. We had a customer in, new customer. She came to us from another shop that she had driving a 92 Buick Park Ave. 92. Think about this a minute. And she was at another repair shop that had been taking her money. And I mean, this guy was taking her money with a dump truck and a bucket loader for the past 15 years, it seems, you know, just spending all kinds of crazy money on this car. And the last problem she had was that the vehicle would stumble and hesitate and stall in traffic. And his answer was he blamed it on the throttle body fuel injection, that GM just built bad throttle body fuel injections. And I said, you're telling me General Motors, a company and a corporate giant of that magnitude, created a vehicle that ran so bad for so long that's the reason and the rationale? And she said, yeah, that's what he kept telling me. I said, well, you know, I don't like to call anybody wrong or a liar until I do some investigating, but I'll let you know what I find. I took the car for a ride. You know, Mackenzie, I sat in that car. I experienced it. I said, the EGR valve's coming on too soon. This is what these did back in the early 90s. All right? Mm-hmm. I put a vacuum delay valve in the EGR feed tube. The problem solved. She'd been living with it for five years. And it's not that Ron's smart. That isn't what this is about. What it's about is working in an independent shop. The dealer guy would never see that because that car would be gone before the dealer guy would see it. And if you're looking for that type of stuff that 15, 20 years from now, you're going to remember what affected the 2019 Hondas and the 2020 Hondas, then now you just got to find the right independent shop. And they're out there. And, you know, listen, if you like working on cars, you're never going to work a day in your life. You just got to find the right cars to work on. You got to find the right environment. All right.
Yep.
You know, if you weren't working on cars, what would you go do? And that becomes a whole nother, you know, scenario.
No idea.
Right. Do this. Are you in North Jersey?
Yes.
Do you know Garfield at all?
I think it's about an hour from me.
Okay. Just for giggles, call up Joe G Automotive. Talk to my friend Joe Garino. All right?
Okay.
I think Joe's looking for somebody. Joe's a real good, clean, up-to-date shop. He's a straight shooter. All right? Mm-hmm. Joe and I talk on occasion. He's, he'll do computer flashing. He'll do all the high-tech stuff, but he'll do all the nuts and bolts stuff, too. Maybe that's where you want to end up. All right, kiddo?
Oh, cool.
See what that does for you. You need more, you know where to find me.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Good luck to you, Mackenzie. Keep on trucking,
brother.
Thank you very much. No, I understand. I understand completely. All right. I got to go. Be well. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor, 855-560-9900. We're back right after this. Don't call us.
That's right. If you call and we're not live, you can leave a message and we'll call you back to get you on the air with Ron. 855-560-9900. Speaking of Ron, here he is.
I know there's a story in here somewhere for a job we did at the shop this week. And it was like a tale of two cities, a tale of two cars and two problems. We had an 05 Chevy Malibu that we were doing brakes on, and the parking brake cables were sticking. And in 05, they incorporated a mechanical ratcheting caliper piston into the caliper that the cable would pull on and spin it out and lock it. And that was the parking brake. Now, the cable was seized. You could see where the sheathing had rubbed against the subframe and created a hole that water got into over time and rusted the cable so that it wasn't allowing it to fully release, which prematurely wore the pads out. And, you know, the whole kebeba, the whole mishigas, as we would say. So we had to find park brake cables. And, you know, to me, I remember this car when she bought it new. But geez, it's 16 years old now. All of a sudden, this, you know, General Motors, the cables have been obsolete for 3 years. So we went out looking, found them at O'Reilly Auto, O'ReillyAuto.com, O'Reilly Auto Parts, and their best buy or their best brake select, brake best select brand. They had the cables there. And we also found them in Dorman. So they're out there. They were out there in the aftermarket, fortunately. Between Dorman and O'Reilly Auto Parts, we were able to get something together and make it work. And that's, you know, that's great. We found that. But that's not the whole story. You know, we put it together. But to put the cables into this 05 Malibu, the back seat had to come out. The carpeting had to come out. The console had to come out. You had to take apart half the car. And I don't know. I'm telling you this story because then the next brake job in the door, the same day, was a 2016 Mazda CX-5. And it was four-wheel brakes. We did four-wheel brakes. But this has electric parking brake calipers. It has a little motor on the back of the brake caliper with a ratcheting piston that spins it in and out as you hit the button on and off. So if your car's got electric parking brake, you've got an electric actuator on the back of the caliper. And you know, you have to put the brakes in maintenance mode with a scan tool. Of course, our Autel does that. We hook the Autel up, put it in maintenance mode, boom. Nice job. They lay it out for you. They tell you what they're doing and when and why. And did the brakes. And then we take out our Autel and, you know, make it out of maintenance mode, and we're good to go. And now the brake is dragging the left rear, the one that was metal on metal when it came in. And I didn't think anything of it at first because the right rear wasn't far behind, but it wasn't grinding. It wasn't metal on metal. Went and found a bulletin from Mazda that talks about this exact problem, that they're having issues with their calipers on this generation vehicles, 15, 16, 17s, CX5, CX9s, under a certain VIN production date, that they're having issues where the internal portion of the caliper and or the actuator and or both are creating binding issues causing the brake to drag. Fortunately, as we were facing Memorial Day weekend, the dealer had the parts. They had an actuator. They had a caliper. They come separately. And they weren't bad. I think it was a collective of $300 or $350 for the one side worth of parts. I think the caliper was 200 and maybe it was 300. The caliper was 200, give or take, and the actuator was 100. Of course, they didn't have the bolts and the gasket kit that you need, which we had to get creative to get the car out the door because the customer needed the car. And it was a quicker, simpler, cleaner repair, right? We had to take the interior apart. There was no more cables. And I couldn't help but look at this and think, this is the future. It's going to be electronics. It's going to be electrical. It's going to be component replacement. We're not going to take interiors apart anymore. We're not going to have to crawl through and underneath and get down into the belly of the vehicle. You're seeing the transition of the automobile go from mechanical nuts and bolts to throw it away and just bolt a new piece on, provided you can get the bolts from the dealer or the manufacturer, whichever the case might be. And I don't know, I just thought it was an interesting scenario that such an extreme difference, all right? It took Danny and I every bit of 3 hours to gut the interior on this Malibu and put it back together for these parking brake cables. And it took us every bit of 45 minutes to do the Mazda because it was just on off, you know? Bleed the caliper, hook the actuator up, boom, you're done. And I'm going to probably take that caliper and the actuator apart one day during the week at the shop and maybe do a little YouTube video, put some up on Facebook or add something to the YouTube channel, which I haven't done in a long time. I've just been so busy. My apologies. But just look at the technology and look where it's going. I can't decide who paid more. I think the Mazda repair cost more because the cables were, $150 for the pair. But the actuator was double that. So, yeah, the Mazda was the higher repair. But it was easier on the mechanic. Maybe that's a good thing. So just look at the technology. Sometimes it's not so bad. You got to embrace it. Hey, coming up next, good old Uncle Steve. Boy, I could tell you 1,000 stories about him, but we're going to let him do the talking here as we look back. Memories of Uncle Steve, Memorial Day. What could be better? Coming up next right here on The Car Doctor. I'm Ron Ananian. Don't go away. Welcome back to The Car Doctor. Ron Ananian here. You know, this next segment really doesn't have a lot to do with cars. It's Memorial Day weekend, and when we can, as we're allowed, we try to sneak out and talk to Uncle Steve. Steven Ananian, he's my uncle. It's always a pleasure to talk to him. I don't get to talk to him as much during the course of the year, so this is a different kind of a long-distance phone call. And it's always fun to have Uncle Steve here, 91 years young, as we talk to him about Memorial Day, World War II. And things maybe not so car related. Uncle Steve, welcome back. Welcome to The Car Doctor, sir. We love you.
How you doing?
All right.
Love you too.
Here we are, Memorial Day.
I'm 90, not 91.
Is it? Well, you know, blame that on Mom. Mom says 91.
So, well, I'm 90 and a half actually now.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. At 90 and a half or 91,
If they called you up and you could fit in the plane, would you go?
Oh, sure. I flew in an AT-6 last year.
Were you flying or just taking the ride?
Well, I was sitting in the back seat, and I flew it for a while.
Yeah. Don't tell anybody, right?
Well, no. I had an instructor in front, so it's okay.
You were okay.
It was legal.
Yeah, right. But, you know, 90 and a half or not, you were 19 when you enlisted when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And you knew what you had to do, and we've talked about it here on the show. And, you know, we've talked about some of the other things with regards to the story that you had written, Ramrod to Munster. Can you just hit the high points for the listeners real quick?
Well, that was my first mission, and we were escorting the bombers to Munster, and escorting bombers is called a ramrod mission. So on the way, I was flying over Holland, over Heligoland, actually, and that's the German West Point for anti-aircraft gunners. And I got hit by one anti-aircraft gun, and I was hitting the supercharger of the aircraft. And I flew my airplane, losing oil for about 45 minutes until I finally had a bailout over the North Sea. And at that time, there was gale warnings over the North Sea with 75-mile winds and 10-foot waves. And so, but I bailed out and was in the water for an hour and a half, and I was rescued by a British air sea rescue flying boat. And I got back naturally, and I flew 63 missions after that.
Did you hesitate going up the second time, Uncle Steve? From what I remember, they offered you a couple of days off leave up in London, and you said, "Heck no, I want to go."
That's right. I went the very next mission that they flew. So I was afraid when I flew, but my fear was not of getting killed, but I was afraid I'd screw up. I mean, this is what every pilot did. I mean, you had to respect what the enemy had to offer, but we knew we were better than them, so there was no big aggravation on that part.
We
had men who were on leave on D-Day, and they rushed back to fly one of them. We flew three missions on D-Day, and these men who were on leave in London rushed back and got back and flew the last mission of the day.
Just to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were up in the air and you saw oil pressures dropping and you were at, I forget the number, 25,000 feet, 30,000 feet, how did you happen to have the clarity of mind to rock the plane to splash oil up on the engine as it was losing oil pressure? I mean, what came over you?
Well, I was hit, I mean, disoriented or anything. I knew what was happening. I knew that I was losing. I was trying to figure out what was wrong, and I figured I was hit in a supercharger, which meant that at lower altitudes I might have enough power to maintain flight, which I did. When I got down to 7,000 feet, my aircraft had enough power to sustain flight. But I was losing oil, and in order to cool the engine, I figured all that oil is in the stump of the engine, you know. So I just shook the plane violently to splash the oil from the stump up on the cylinder walls.
The ME-262, Uncle Steve, one of the German jets.
The German jet.
Yeah, you shot down a German jet in combat. And that was really unprecedented then in terms of, you know, the differences between the planes. The ME-262 was obviously faster, but you figured it out. I mean, how did you take, you know, what mechanical advantage do you think the P-51 had over the 262 that enabled you to do that? Or, you know, are you going to sit here and tell me it was just a lucky shot?
The thing is, Ron, that both the P-51 and the ME-62 were limited to the top speed by the speed of sound. We had not broken the sound barrier at that time. So the fastest they could fly was about 600 miles an hour, which is the fastest that we could if we could, but we didn't have the power. The P-51 flew 475 miles an hour, top speed, straight and level. And so in a dive, we could fly 575 miles an hour. In fact, the aircraft was a red line not to fire the guns at that speed. So even though they had a speed advantage, we had a maneuverability advantage. The P-51 was a highly maneuverable aircraft, and we could outmaneuver the ME-262. So that was our advantage over them.
The time you were shot down over Stuttgart, can you talk about that real quick? I mean, what was going through your mind?
There was a tank battle going on at the ground, and we were supporting our ground tanks. And I was hit by an American tank, I think, and in the carburetor, and I lost power, and it crash landed in a deserted field. And there were German Wehrmacht on the other side of the field, and I ran off into the woods after I set my airplane on fire, and I shot a fire flare into the cockpit, and I ran off into the woods, and I hid behind some bushes, and I was able to evade capture, and I woke up. I fell asleep in the shrubbery, and I woke up when it was dark, and I walked in the dark toward American lines, and I was able to evade capture.
You know, Stuttgart isn't exactly around the corner from American lines, Uncle Steve. I mean, it had to be 100 miles, no?
Well, I don't exactly recall the distance, but yeah, it took me three nights.
And you hit out by day and traveled at night.
Yeah, I woke up one morning in a field that I was sleeping in, and I could hear some French being spoken, and I stood up, and there was a French farmer talking to a American soldier, and I raised my hands and I said, "Je suis américain," and I was taken to Paris, which was headquarters at the time, and I was interrogated because at that time there were German English-speaking Germans that were posing as American soldiers, and their job was to try to assassinate Dwight Eisenhower, who was the general at the time.
Right, right. Uncle Steve, stay put. We're going to put you into a second segment, if that's all right. I know we promised you only one, but we've got to hold you over. It's just too much fun talking to you, and it's just too interesting. Stay where you are. I'm Ron Anani and the Car Doctor. We'll be back right after this. Back, Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor, here with Uncle Stephen Ananian. Stephen Ananian, First Lieutenant Stephen Ananian, 339th Fighter Group, the 505 Fighter Group, the 8th Air Force, World War II. As we always, we try to get a hold of Uncle Stephen Memorial Day and talk to him about some of the things that happened during the course of the war. Not really automotive mechanical related, but just a fun time. Uncle Steve, how are you? You're still there, sir.
I'm still here.
You know, I can't imagine walking 3 days home from Stuttgart, Germany at night. But I guess that was the time, right? You did what you had to do to survive.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it just never became...
Hey, look, we were young kids. I mean, 19 years old, walking is not that difficult.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Although, you know, you say it now like it's so nonchalant, but back then to walk out of Stuttgart, Germany, back to French lines is no simple task. The final flight, and I love this story when you tell it, if I remember it correctly, VE Day, and everybody was grounded, but you still went up, didn't you?
Yes.
And
when you said everybody was grounded, we were able to fly training missions and so forth over England itself.
But you just wanted to go for one last ride in that plane before they sent you home.
That's true.
And do you remember anything specifically about it?
Oh yeah, well, I was scheduled to leave the base about 12 o'clock noon to catch fly up to Scotland to catch a boat back for the United States, and so I got up about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we all woke up that early, and I spoke to the commanding officer, my squadron commander, and I said, "Sir, I'd like to take the airplane up one last time. With your permission." And he said, "Sure, go ahead." He said, "But just don't fool around." He says, "I don't want any problems, you know." And my wingman, Tom Marvel, he said, "I'd like to fly with him." So we both took off and we flew. I had never flown over Paris, France, because Paris was an open city. So I flew to France, and when I got over Paris, I flew along the Champs-Élysées with my wingman flying my wing about 50 feet off the ground, and all the people were waving at us, and we were just smiling and laughing. And then we turned at the end of the Champs-Élysées is the Palais de Chaillot, and I made a left turn, and there's the Eiffel Tower. We headed towards the Eiffel Tower, buzzed that, and then flew back to London. Now, during the war, you couldn't fly over London because of the barrage balloons, but on VE Day, the barrage balloons were down, so we flew over Trafalgar Square, very low, and spiraled upward over Lord Nelson's statue and climbed up to 20,000 feet, came back. And we came back and landed. When we landed, my commanding officer's jeep came roaring up to my airplane, and he jumped out, and he said, "What the hell have you been doing?" I said, "What's the matter, sir?" He says, "The phone's been ringing off the hook about these red and white checkered-nosed P-47s buzzing all over France and England." And I said, "That wasn't us." I said, "We fly P-51. He says, "Baloney." He said, "Those civilians don't know a P-51 from a P-47.
Yeah, but still,
you climb into this I-86 and you're going to Scotland. So that was it.
And that was it. Hey, real quick, Uncle Steve. You named the plane Baby Mine. 30 seconds or less. How'd you come up with that name?
The Walt Disney's motion picture.
No. I don't want that version.
Had Dumbo in it, and he in that picture. That was the famous song, and that song used to go run through my head when I was flying.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Uncle Steve. That's the family version. Wasn't there a story about when the girls in the bars in London would ask you, "Did you name your plane after me?" And what did you tell them?
That's right. I'd say, "I named it after you, baby." And they'd look at me and say, "Oh, come on, I yank." And I'd take out a picture of my airplane, and they believed it.
And said it was Baby Mine. Uncle Steve, as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm looking forward to seeing you in June. And we've got to go right now. I really want to say thanks for taking the time, and it's just a whole lot of fun to talk to you. I love you.
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
I just want to thank all these people in the service for protecting us and giving us the freedom that we enjoy. And our prayers are with all these people. Thank you.
Thank you, Uncle Steve. We'll see you soon. I'm Ron Ananian and the Car Doctor. We're back right after this. Such a hard act to follow. Such a, what can I say about Uncle Steve, right? It's so good to hear him, even though it's on tape. I wish he was really here. I always think whenever I hear his voice, I go back 20 years. There's so many Uncle Steve stories I could tell you. It was about 20 years ago. I was
doing a TV show and the radio show and running the shop and in the midst of buying a new building and moving the shop and trying to have a life somewhere in the middle. And I was overwhelmed. You know, I was right to the top. And who else would I call but Uncle Steve? I just had to get it sorted out in my brain, right? We're all human. We all go through this. And I think this is probably the most fitting, poignant memory I've got of him in that I called him up and, you know, complaining about what was going on. And, oh, my God, Uncle Steve, how am I going to make all this work? And what can I do? And he very calmly said over the phone, he said, "You're an Ananian. You can do anything." He said, "Remember, nobody's shooting at you. Just don't go shooting back. Get up off your butt. Go do something." He said, "You can do this." And you know what? He was right. And that was that generation and all the generations that have come on since. It's been great being with you this week. I love each and every one of you. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. Remember what it's all about. Till the next time, good mechanics aren't expensive. They're priceless. See ya.